I'm John Holmes. I'm a medical informatician and epidemiologist at the University of Pennsylvania in the Center for Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics. And I have actually two interests in informatics, one of which is totally unrelated to this, which has to do with epidemiologic surveillance and information systems for that enterprise. But my other interest is in terms of patient-physician communication, and particularly how we can use informatics methods and approaches to enhancing patient-physician communication and think about especially the application to areas of health disparities. So this is a project, which is funded by the National Cancer Institute as part of the Centers for Population Health and Health Disparities. We are one of the 8 funded centers throughout the country at Penn, and we have a very multidisciplinary, and in fact they're telling us to say transdisciplinary team now at this point. And I'd like to just give some credit to those folks. So Ransom Weaver is actually our multimedia designer, who I've worked with before in the past on a number of other health-related interventions. Carmen Guerra is an internist with us at Penn, who has a specific interest in patient counseling and physician-patient communication, specifically with regard to cancer screening. Dominic Frosch is a clinical psychologist who also was a Robert Wood Johnson Health and Society Scholar at Penn up until about 2 years ago, and now he's on the faculty at UCLA. Ruth Ann Alton and Marita Curran are two of my research coordinators on this project. Judy Shea is an evaluation specialist. She's also a social psychologist, and she's been instrumental in helping us to develop the questionnaires and scales of things of that nature. And some of you might know Bob Hornick, who is a very senior faculty member in the Annenberg School of Communication, and his specialty is in health communication and mass communication in particular. So this is about, first of all, I guess I should tell you a little bit about that acronym. PROSPECT is prostate cancer screening and encouraging communication is where it comes from. And what we're trying to do here with this intervention is to enhance the discussions that occur between men and their physician in the primary care setting with regard to prostate cancer screening. So this is a very technology-supported, as you can imagine, after all being an informatician and also having Ransom on the project, this is a very IT-intensive project, but it's also very patient-centered, as you'll find out. And we've taken a number of different approaches and utilized them all sort of all together in a very multimodal approach to developing this intervention. Oh, good, the mouse works. Okay. So just a little bit of background for those of you who aren't familiar. Prostate cancer screening among asymptomatic men is very controversial, primarily because the tests that are used for it, namely the digital rectal examination and the prostate-specific antigen, both have fairly poor test characteristics. And unless you set the threshold for the PSA low, somewhere around 2 or 3 nanograms per milliliter, well then you can end up actually missing a number of prostate cancers. On the other hand, you can also have a number of false positives if you set it that low, which means that then men go on to have an invasive procedure, namely the ultrasound-guided transrectal biopsy, which is invasive, it's painful, and in and of itself is also not particularly good as a diagnostic procedure. So the other thing, too, is that this is a series of downstream decisions that have to be made. This isn't just about the diagnostic testing that would happen after a positive PSA and a positive DRE, or digital rectal exam. This is also about the decisions that have to be made downstream. So what do you do if you come back with a positive biopsy? It could very easily end up that you don't, in fact, have prostate cancer, or at least the type that should result in a radical prostatectomy, which in and of itself has some very severe implications for such things as incontinence and impotence, as you probably know. So treatment can reduce the quality of life, and it's unclear that treatment itself actually reduces prostate cancer mortality. So a lot of this is very much up in the air right now. There are a number of clinical trials that are looking at these screening tests to try to determine, well, first of all, are they really any good? And second of all, can new ones be developed that might be better? So the current guidelines, keeping all this in mind, is that practitioners should discuss screening with patients. That's number one. So if you look at the Preventive Medicine Task Force, and all the various other guidelines, with the exception of the American Cancer Society, which is an advocacy group but has a slightly different slant on all of this, The idea here is that they can't recommend or recommend against having prostate cancer screening. The idea here is that you need to discuss it with your patient as a practitioner and come to a shared decision-making conclusion that will help the patient make up his mind as to where he wants to go with this. And also, the physician can be a part of that process, obviously, as well. So this discussion, the problem is that this discussion is not, and a shared decision-making process, is not as prevalent when the patient is African-American, and particularly when the physician or the primary care provider is Caucasian. And thus, African-Americans might be at a higher risk of prostate cancer. They might be not getting screened, or they might be getting screened without being told that they are. Therefore, they're not brought into the shared decision-making process. And the difficulty with that is that what do you do when you get a call at 8 o'clock at night from your primary care doc saying, oops, you've got a positive PSA, we have to get you in for a biopsy, which is, again, a part of that downstream decision-making that has to occur, and some of it is not particularly pleasant to consider. So the objective of this project is to develop and evaluate a patient-centered intervention designed to address the racial disparity in the incidence, the number of times these discussions occur, and also the quality of these prostate cancer screening discussions. So the purpose of the intervention is to provide men with knowledge and skills needed to initiate and participate in a discussion about prostate cancer screening with their physician. So I will tell you why that would even possibly be successful in just a few minutes as I go over some of my preliminary results. So our methods for developing the intervention were informed by preliminary qualitative research and an evidence-based ontology implemented in Protégé. Some of you might know this. It's software that's freely available from Stanford University for modeling ontologies or creating knowledge models. And these were both guided by the systems model of clinical preventive care. So we have a conceptual framework which is driving the whole thing, but we have a number of different approaches using that for keeping that framework in mind the whole way through. The intervention prototypes, we used a rapid prototyping method, so we would create, or we did create, a number of different prototypes along the way, constantly aiming to not to reinvent them, but to improve them based on feedback from lay groups in particular, groups of laymen working in the focus group setting. So this is a conceptual framework in case some of you don't know. Do I have a pointer? I don't think so. Okay, well, up at the top, basically overall, this is all about communication. This is all about the interaction between a patient and a physician or a practitioner of any type. So this could be an NP, for example, or a PA. So the person on the left over there without the stethoscope is the patient, and then the practitioner is on the right. And the whole idea here is that starting up at the top, think of this as a funnel. Starting up at the top, you have a number of predisposing factors and reinforcing factors that provide for us just the names of those, not even the names of the specific factors, but the names of those categories, reinforcing factors and predisposing factors. So predisposing could be demographics, for example, and reinforcing could be access to educational materials. Enabling materials or factors, which is down at the next level, could be something like access to transportation or availability of office hours, you see. So all of those things affect both the physician or the practitioner and the patient. So in between these two individuals, you have all sorts of things going on. There are healthcare delivery factors, organizational factors, for example, how's the practice set up? There might be some guidelines in the practice, or that might be driven by an HMO, or might be driven by a health system policy that say, no PSAs, ever. We're not going to do them. Or they might have the opposite type of policy. So those are things which are obviously going to affect how these discussions occur. There are also preventive activity factors, such as educating patients about appropriate diet and avoiding alcohol, and some of those things that we think might help to avoid prostate cancer. And then situational factors, and this was a big one for us, because this is where we have the cues to action. Those of you who have worked in this area, patient-physician communication, and trying to spur people on to make a decision, trying to get them over the hump, as it were, that's all about giving them a cue, which causes them to change from one state to the next. Okay, in our case, the state would be reticence. They were not discussing the prostate exam, but then after this intervention, we were trying to get them to the point where they would actually initiate the discussion. And I'll tell you why that's important in just a second, as opposed to having the practitioner do it. Okay, so to inform this, we had three sources of information. We have an evidence-based ontology, which I'll describe in a second, community-based interviews that we conducted with men from the community, from the Philadelphia area, primarily the urban area in Philadelphia, and physician interviews, primary care physician interviews, that is. So the evidence-based ontology looked at over 800 items in the literature, in the academic literature, in the popular press, and in transcripts of news reports. I'm sure we've all seen the news reports, you know, the medical reporter who comes on at the evening news and tells you about the latest hot new thing in diagnosis or screening or treatment or whatever. And, you know, that has a very strong impact, not to mention, of course, drug ads do as well. We coded the items in Protégé, and I'll give you the website down here if you're interested in downloading this. As I mentioned, it's open source. It's freely available. It's at protege.stanford.edu, if you can't see it in the back. We used the systems model as a framework. That gave us the basic slots for the ontology, and then we refined those slots and went deeper and deeper and deeper, as you'll see in just a second. And then we looked for the relationships between those slots, between those classes. Okay, so this is a real taxonomic, ontologic approach here that we felt was very important because, after all, docs read the literature, and lay people are exposed to all sorts of things out there in the world by way of medically related information. So this actually comes from Protégé, and this demonstrates you. I know you can't see it in the back, but going over to the far left, the highest level in the ontology is factor, any kind of factor. And there are a whole bunch of them here on the, in the middle layer. The cue to action factor, an enabling factor, healthcare system factor, etc. So this all very much relates to those very high level slots in the systems model. That's where this comes from. And then within that, we use that as a guide to identify what some of the things are that we would need potentially to approach with the design of this intervention. So under enabling, for example, insurance coverage, education, and by the way, as you know, enabling factors apply to both practitioner and patient, so it's education for both. You see? So let me see here. Proximity to care. How close is it to get to your primary care provider? Predisposing factors are things like health beliefs, which are incredibly important for us as we go through this whole process, and I'll make a mention of some of the things that we actually found during our focus groups with both in the community interviews and the community setting, that is, and also with doing the focus groups with the intervention. And then we can break that out even more. So this is a predisposing factor, and you see it's broken down into attitudes, demographics, expectations, health beliefs, and the like. So we actually had items in these other slots, these sub-slots. So for example, an attitude could be mistrust, a big problem in this business, a huge problem. There's lots of literature on it. And within that, there's these little eyes next to, you can't see them, they're sort of purple eyes next to each one of these attitude facets, as we call them, actually opens up a whole bibliography specific to, in this case, attitudes, or beliefs, or, you know, things of that nature. Okay, does that make sense so far? Okay, so the community interviews, we recruited 18 African-American males and 14 Caucasian men from the UPHS, from the University of Pennsylvania Health System, and a small local paper advertisement. It doesn't sound like very many, but frankly, this was plenty. We did these interviews one at a time. These were not done in a focus group setting. We reserved that primarily for the system development process. So these were one-on-one, right? Interviews that my researchers actually ran, and we taped them, transcribed them, and went back to that ontology and used that to code these interviews. Okay, so this is a lot of where the qualitative research really comes to the fore. To get into this interview process, you had to be between the ages of 40 and 75, and we wanted to start at 40 rather than 50 because of increasing recognition that particularly in African American men, it's a good thing to start screening when they're 45. At least that's the ACS recommendation. Okay, so we wanted to actually start the discussion at that point. And then, of course, no prior prostate history of any kind. So no BPH, no prostate cancer, no actually even prostatitis. We didn't want to have anybody participate at this level who might have their, you know, their ears up for a particular prostate pathology. So we used a semi-structured interview. You see here questions about healthcare, thoughts and opinions about prostate cancer and prostate cancer screening, about health discussions, you know, how comfortable are you about discussing with your doc, and we used a number of locus of control scales and computer usage, because we felt that that was sort of important, seeing as this was going to be a computerized intervention. Then we also conducted, actually it was Dr. Guerra, who was my collaborator on this project, ran a group of physician interviews. There were 17, let me step back a second. The methods were actually this chart-stimulated recall method that she's been using a lot in colorectal cancer screening, where you would call up the practitioner about a week in advance and ask them, once they consent, obviously, and ask them to pull maybe 10 or 20 charts of patients they've seen in the past 2 weeks. Then you go in and meet with the practitioner, and you ask them, why did you do this, or why didn't you do that? And she focused specifically on screening behaviors. Okay, so we had 17 completed interviews, 9 from internal medicine faculty, 3 from family medicine faculty. By the way, our faculty see patients out in the neighborhood, so this is not that biased sample, but we did want to get out into the neighborhood and look a little more deeply, so we recruited 5 additional physicians from our clinical care associates, and these are primarily people, physicians and MPs, who are actually working out in the neighborhoods, usually in solo or very small group practices, and they're all either family medicine or internal medicine. Okay. Great. Okay, so the implications are that we wanted to model shared decision-making behavior in a realistically presented setting. We wanted to tailor the content, but just a quick word about tailoring. Tailoring can be overdone in my particular view, and I think that there are a number of people who feel the same way about that too, because you never really can tease out exactly what all of the effects are. It's not just a multifactorial problem, it's actually a Latin square problem when you come right down to it. And you end up having to create versions of the intervention for every possible tailoring outcome or choice. So we stuck with just the, we wanted to make sure that we were at a reasonable educational level, and as you'll find out, we were also tailored to the practitioner and to the patient as far as the roles that they wanted to play here. It's intended to address patients' specific concerns about prostate cancer and prostate cancer screening. And also, we want to provide a hard copy artifact that they can take into the exam room with them. This is meant to be experienced before they go into the exam room. And so they would walk in with a sheet of paper. And the sheet of paper is designed to be a set of talking points, essentially, to initiate the conversation. If they're having trouble articulating, this is just yet another layer to help them do that. So the intervention design uses elements from Donald Segal's PACE method, or PACE model, of physician-patient communication. Intervention scripts were developed by us on the team, and we played them back with other groups of individuals, with focus groups of men from the community. The intervention incorporates tailoring on physician race and gender, and patient race. We had professional actors involved in this process. And they were following a script to basically simulate a patient encounter, a one-on-one patient encounter that models good physician-patient communication. So the scenario is punctuated by narration and interaction to reinforce the key points, particularly with the PACE model. We changed it to the ACE model. But here's how it works. Here's our modification. P is for present. Present your, basically your case, essentially, to the doc or the practitioner. But we started with asking questions. We wanted to get the patient in there, start asking questions. We know why they're there. They're there for a primary care checkup, essentially. They have to check their understanding once information comes back in this asking or question and answering period, and expressing any concerns. You know, like, oh my gosh, what do I do? If this test isn't any good, but on the other hand, it might find something, what do I do? So there's a back and forth that goes on here between the concerns and the checking understanding. So this is what the intervention looks like. This is what the user, our research subjects, but actually patients, will look at first. And these are our 4 physicians. As you can see, we have 2 African Americans, 2 Caucasians, and 1 male, 1 female for each one. So you can pick whoever you want to play the physician in this scenario. This is how you would tailor on yourself. You pick the patient you want to represent you in this scenario. By the way, this doesn't mean that we had to actually create a total of, what would it be, 16 different scenario or different acting periods. My multimedia guys were fantastic at this and said, no, you don't need to do that. You can plug and play. You just have to have them do the specialized portions of the script. So, just to let you know. And this is what an encounter sort of looks like. Well, it does look like this, actually. And there's a lot of speech that goes on with this. And as I mentioned, during the course of the encounter, there is a lot of this kind of reinforcement. Okay? So, again, ask questions, check understanding, and express concerns. So, along the way, during the course of the intervention, during the course of the simulated patient encounter, there are places where the patient should be asking questions, and there are places where understanding should be checked, and where concerns should be expressed. And we identified them in the throughout the course of the intervention, and they pop up on the screen. So our next steps are to evaluate this design by focus groups, which we're cleaning up right now. We're just about finished with that. We also have individual interviews to look for usability and usefulness issues and see if there's anything missing. We were very shocked and surprised, not too pleasantly either, by our assumption that from previous studies that I've worked on that men didn't want any risk information. Like, how much risk would I be if my PSA came back? What's the probability that I actually have prostate cancer? Those data are virtually not available. So it's a very difficult situation. However, the CDC does, at their cancer control website, does have some preliminary data that we're going to think about using, and we have that we're going to evaluate it very shortly over the next couple of weeks with our focus groups. And then we want to evaluate the efficacy of the intervention by a quasi-experimental pre-post intervention design. It so happens that in our situation, a randomized clinical trial just wasn't possible financially or logistically. So this is about the best we can do. So that's okay, because we're doing the pre-collection right now with a great deal of care. We're taping or audio taping clinical encounters. We're transcribing them. We're going to compare. We're going to code them using the systems model again, and also some grounded theory thrown in to see if we can find any additional facets. And then we'll compare them. We'll do the same process post-intervention after we implement this in a series of practices. So in conclusion, participatory design is absolutely key. If there's one take-home message from this, don't design a patient intervention, especially a computerized one, without thinking about who the target audience is here. And I know I'm probably preaching to the choir here because you're all about informatics or about computerized interventions or patient-physician communication. But this is absolutely essential. I can't tell you how many times I've seen interventions that obviously were just sort of invented in a vacuum. And this intervention is the first to use informatics and information technology in focusing on racial disparities in discussing prostate cancer screening. There have been other interventions that are informed this way for looking at other things like hypertension. In fact, I had the opportunity to work on that one as a co-investigator. But this is the first one to look at this very complicated question of prostate cancer screening. It's complicated in the extreme, actually, to try to get people to understand what this is about. It's not about increasing the incidence of prostate cancer screening. That's not what we want to do. Well, we might, but that's not what the point of this study is. So we were sponsored by the CPHHD, the Center for Population Health Disparities at Penn, and ultimately back at NCI under that Public Health Services grant number. Okay, I'm sorry, I went a little bit over, I'm sure.
Thank you very much, Dr. John. Okay. We do have time for questions.
Good question. It is when we originally started the ontology, we knew we wanted to do the ontology, and it was a large part of our proposal. In fact, we were originally going to do a semi-automated, basically a role-playing game type of approach, and use the ontology to drive that as a way to thread through the decision tree that underlies the game. That became rather impossible because of financial constraints on our award. Unfortunately, that happens. So we were cut basically 22% along with everybody else, and that just wasn't possible. So we've stuck with a more traditional method, but it was still extremely useful. So more from perhaps a taxonomic point of view than just an ontology, because we're not using the ontology as a computerized framework per se. You see, so for those of you who aren't familiar with this, generally when you have an ontology, you think of that as being a computerized taxonomy. It gives you sort of a hierarchical framework with relationships, semantic relationships between concepts, that can be exploited in a computer program. And so we're not actually doing that with this. But I have done it with other interventions, but they didn't have their funny cuts. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I think it's very important, especially in informatics. Well, let's put it this way. Informatics interventions, I think, are very amenable to that kind of an approach. And really, it should be de rigueur, because it's there are plenty of these models out there. You've mentioned several. There are additional ones, you know, theory of planned behavior, et cetera, that could be used as sort of a framework for thinking about the way this intervention is going to sit and where it's going to be, how it's going to be deployed. It helps keep you also in touch with your users, which is absolutely critical, totally foundational, and very easy to lose sight of unless you have the right hand, or in this case, the bottom side of the model to constantly guide you.